repeaters. Not all. Most repeaters are offset plus or minus 600 KC, plus or minus. The ones at 147 megs are usually positive offset. The ones at 146 megs are negative offset, and normally 0.6 megacycle, 600 KC of offset. A number of the repeaters have an unusual offset, one megacycle offset. So you can select one megacycle offset. In other words, it might listen to 146.95 and transmit on 147.95, one megacycle offset. And there are a small number of repeaters that have that crazy offset, one megacycle. I wonder if anyone else wants to give Sid an answer on that. If I happen to be wrong, give me a call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet, wait for the beep. Yeah, since no one broke in, I may have guessed right on that. So the plus one may be the capability to select one megacycle of offset as opposed to 600 KC, because a small number of repeaters do that in order to offset themselves from the other repeaters around them. That's what I think is going on there, Sid. W2JIC, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Dick, yes, that's exactly what I was asking. I understand duplexes and plus and minus and all that, and I understand that, yeah, usually it's 600 up or down, and different, of course, when we get up into 440. But that's what I thought. I see that on occasion here. I pulled up a list of repeaters in the New York City area. I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska. I moved up here about 3 months ago, and I haven't found any clubs yet that I can join. And I'm just kind of sitting around in my shack in the evening and listening to 2 meters, and just kind of see what's happening and what's interesting. And I ran across you guys. Very interesting, very interesting. And so I'm going to get into some D-Star in a few weeks here, or when my radio gets back from the shop, through to the D-Star. I run, for HF, I run 40 and 20 meters, of course, and a little bit of 80 at night. But I'll turn it back to you guys. Let me drop here quickly. So anyway, I thank you for the information, and I'll stand by and be listening. Once again, great job you're doing there. This is Whiskey 2, JIC.
NQEO, Dick, I have a question if there's a phone link.
We're going to make time for you, Rich. Yeah, James, there are a number of pretty good clubs in New Jersey. One of them is the Bergen County Amateur Radio Association. They also have, or at least in the past, they had a TechNet that meets on Thursday nights, I think at 9 o'clock. I've forgotten the frequency that they're on. So Bergen County Amateur Radio Club. With a little bit of searching, you're going to find there's a number of good clubs in New Jersey. So good luck with that. And if you have trouble finding a club, you're allowed to come back to the TechNet and say, hey, you guys, can you suggest a club that is near Maplewood, near Elwood Avenue in Maplewood? I'm having some fun with you, Jim. Okay, good luck with that, and please come back and let us know how you are in finding a club. By the way, it's a nice picture of you in front of a piano. I presume that you are either a musician or a piano tuner. Let me turn it back to you for a quick one on that one, James. W2JIC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I tuned a piano once and then had to call in a tuner to have him finish that for me. No, I'm a player. I've been doing it for 50 years. My specialty is Kansas City jazz. I like to play the blues. I also kick a B3, or a Hammond B3 around on occasion. But I've had little jazz trios, and I've had a couple of very good blues bands. And kind of retired now, but starting to get back to feeling again as I want to start playing again. And I got to find some cats around here, some musicians around here that would like to play, but that's a little bit further on down the road. I mean, still getting settled into the house here, but thanks for asking, and thanks on the picture there. 73, gentlemen, I'll check back with you again at times. It's Whiskey 2, JIC. Thanks again.
And I have a question about Oscar, Dick, when I get a chance.
Okay, you're going to be right after Rich. On his website, on his write-up on... WQRZ.com, Jim says, professional jazz blues singer and player by choice. So that man knows jazz. Okay. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead with your question.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I'll comment first. He likes jazz like Billie Holiday. I'm sure he's familiar with Billie Holiday, one of the best blues jazz singers ever. Dick, question I have, you know, I run a Cushcraft R8 vertical, which is a electrical half-wave vertical. It covers 40 through 10 meters. And I don't know, I want to run this by you. I was thinking of changing it this coming summer, only because I heard somebody on 20 meters coming through like a house on fire with a 44-foot, 4-inch vertical that he said he didn't have radios on it. Let me let it drop. I did some further investigation. MFJ is making one. DX Engineering is making one. 44-foot, 4-inch. They say tuner with a tuner, but they say radios are required, which I would expect for a quarter-wave vertical on, say, 75 meters. This gentleman had a rod in the ground, and like I say, he was coming to like a house on fire, so, and he was telling the other fellow he was working that he's getting out like crazy with this thing. So I'm just wondering what you thought, because my backyard is only 25 feet wide, and I have about 25 feet deep because I had a deck put up this summer, so it's quite restricted. I know the antenna base currents are highest close into the base of the antenna. If I run radios out, would it be a waste of time to put, say, 20 or 30 radios out that are maybe each about 8-10 feet long? And Barry in 2MB said he's an ambitious guy. He suggested to me that he drive 40 or 50 feet of well point into the ground with a long rod to make up the other half of the antenna. But I don't know how well that works. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW and 2EM.
I think I've got some pretty good guesses as an answer for you, Rich. The most basic antenna is a dipole. And a dipole fed in the center at a reasonable distance above the ground is something like 73 ohm impedance. If I start making the dipole out of pretty fat material, maybe I can start coming down to a 50 ohm impedance, but in that order. When I feed a quarter wave ground plane vertical antenna, it really is half of a dipole, and the other half is the mirror image in the ground. So the half that I'm feeding is half of 70 ohms. It's around 35 ohms. If I make it out of skinny material, if I make it out of fat material, where the basic dipole would have been 50, I'm feeding half of it's 25 ohms. So because you're feeding somewhere between 25 and 37 ohms of impedance on a quarter wave ground plane, and all of that counterpoise action, in other words, where the charge is coming from when you feed the quarter wave monopole, current going into it and current going out of it, you're feeding a 35 or a 50, 25 ohm. Here we go. Somewhere between 25 and 37 ohm impedance, a lot of current is flowing in the ground plane. Therefore, those radials are real required. When I decide to make the radiator a half wave long, and if I decide to feed the outer edge of a half wave dipole, I'm feeding something like a 1500 ohm impedance instead of the 70 ohms in the center, or the 37 ohms if I'm feeding only a quarter wave monopole from the center, if you know what I mean. 1500 ohms, almost 50 times higher in impedance. Therefore, the current that flows from the counterpoise into the antenna is 50 times lower. Now you've got some gut feel as to why, when a guy sets up a spiral monopole-like antenna on 20 meters on the 10th floor of an apartment building on his balcony, and he's using as the counterpoise nothing but the metal railing of the balcony, and the antenna works like
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout.
The antenna works like a charm because the amount of current flowing into the counterpoise is very small. The antenna itself, when it's a half wave long, is a resonating structure. It's a kind of flywheel. and you're trying to set up a certain amount of energy bouncing back and forth on an antenna, which is the equivalent of you're setting up a certain rotation rate of the flywheel. And the antenna is running with a Q of at least 20. That means there's 20 times more stored energy per cycle than there is dissipated. You could also turn it around the other way, saying that the energy is going to bounce back and forth 20 times in the antenna through the resonance structure before it finally gets radiated into space. So if you're feeding the flywheel, so to speak, way out at the perimeter where the impedance is very high, that's what you're doing when you're feeding the dipole from the outer end. You're doing a very gentle push, very similar to what happens when you got somebody on a swing. If it's a very efficient swing, it takes only a little bit of push with proper timing each time the person goes swinging through the bottom of the swinging action for you to eventually build up a pretty strong amount of swing. You could be standing on an icy ground pushing the person on the swing, and as long as you're willing to take some time to eventually build up the amount of stored energy, you can see how you'd be able to do it. And that's very, very similar to what's going on here. You're feeding a very high impedance. The actual current on each individual cycle is small, and therefore the counterpoise becomes almost unrequired. One simple ground rod could do it. Let me drop. Because you're now drawing so little current, 1/50 of the current from the counterpoise, to feed that antenna the resonant energy, you're able to use one simple ground rod, get away with the radials entirely. The center of radiation is higher up. The center of the dipole is where the high current is. That's where the strong magnetic field is. That's where I believe the majority of the radiation is taking place. So your center of radiation is high above the ground, as opposed to a quarter wave ground plane is right at the ground. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why the ground plane radios are very important, so you're not feeding a lot of energy into that dirt. Now, in your particular case, with that half-wave electronic resonator fed from the bottom, as you start going from the simple ground plane rod over to a bunch of radials, are you going to see improvement? Yes. But is the improvement going to be significant? I think the answer is no. I think you're going to get 5% improvement if you lay down a whole bunch of radials. I think you're going to get 95% of the performance if you lay down no radials, once you realize the 50-to-1 current ratio in your way of feeding versus the alternate way of feeding. I wonder if you see that principle, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'm familiar with that, Dick. I'm already familiar with what I know what you're referring to. What I'm getting at, though, this would be basically a non-resonant antenna, 44 feet, 4 inches. Maybe I didn't make myself clear. Used on 8010. Now, it's more than a quarter wave on all bands, except once you get down to 40 meters, it's a little more than a quarter wave. And 80 meters, of course, it's not, you know, 66 feet is a quarter wave. So my question is, I want to use this on all bands. According to MFJ and VX Engineering, they say run cable to it, use a tuner, or you could put what works better as a tuner out at the base of the antenna. Running that thing on 75, just what is your gut feeling how it's going to do compared to my half-wave inverted V? If I drive, you know, like I said, Barry is very ambitious. He wanted to drive 50 feet of well point into the ground. Does that really make the other half of the antenna?
And now that I'm understanding that the 44 feet and some number of inches of pipe is going to be fed on a whole bunch of bands, 80 to 10 meters, and depending on which of the bands you're talking about and how many ground plane radials you lay down, what performance difference is going to be, you are able to evaluate that on each individual band, Rich. Believe it or not, you've got the raw data to do it. You know on each one of those bands, your 44 feet is what fraction of a wavelength. You can convert that into degrees. Quarter wavelength would be 90 degrees. Half wavelength would be 80 degrees. How many degrees long is the electronic length of your radiator? Once you know that number of degrees, and you go to the Brown and Woodward curves, they will tell you exactly what impedance you're going to see, the resistive component and the reactive component. Once you know what that impedance is, you know how much current you're going to be feeding into it. And you can compare the quarter wave ground plane, which is feeding something like a 35 ohm impedance, and lots of ground plane radios are required, you can use that as your base of comparison. Now, on the particular frequency, let me drop. On the particular frequency where your radiator is a half wavelength long or a multiple of a half wavelength long. In that particular situation, you're feeding a 1500 ohm impedance. The Brown and Woodward curve is going to tell you that. Amateurradio.tv gives you access to those curves. You now know a 1500 ohm impedance is almost 50 times higher. Therefore, the current coming from your counterpoise is 50 times lower. The amount of need for the counterpoise goes down by 50 to 1 on that particular frequency. And now you can study each one of the other bands, know exactly how many degrees long the radiator is on that particular frequency. The Brown-Woodward curve is going to tell you exactly what impedance you're going to see. Therefore, you can calculate exactly what current you're going to be pumping into the antenna in your impedance matching network to the ground. Therefore, you can know where are you on that scale between the 1500 ohm, 1/50th of current case, versus the unity current case of the quarter wave radiator. So by way of those curves, you can figure out what's going to happen on each one of those bands. You can figure out how much, in a relative manner, you can figure out how much of a need you've got for a full set of quarter wave long multiple ground plane radials on that band. It's not an exact answer, but it's going to give you a pretty good ballpark. I wonder if you see that principle, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet. Hello, Rich.
Yeah, Vic. Did Vic just change frequency? I got, when you said N2EO, I thought you cut out. Am I getting through okay?
You're getting through beautifully. We waited a few seconds and go right ahead.
Okay, I think we got it now, Vic.
You got it now. You sound good. And so, I wonder if you see the principle of what I said. I hope you heard all of it. And if not, I'll repeat some of it. Go ahead, Rich.
Well, I got it all, Dick. When you said N2EO, you cut out before you said K2RIW. Well, I cut out, actually. I don't know. The big hot frequency. I'm upstairs right now. No, I understand what you're saying. And now I understand why this guy was coming through like he was on 20 meters. With a 44-foot, 4-inch vertical, he was more than a halfway wave long, so he didn't really need much of a ground system on 20 meters. Now, once you get down to 40, you're starting to run, 33 feet is a quarter wave, so you're starting to do a little more than a quarter wave, and as you go down to 75 meters, the impedance is going to probably drop down to 10 to 12 ohms. So I can see what you're saying. The lower in frequency you go, the lower the impedance, the more the radials become necessary because the base currents go up. Last question, Vic. I don't know. Actually, a two-part of it. Am I wasting my time if I have to go a fraction less than a quarter wave? I can only get radials out 10 to 12 feet. I could put many of them out. That's a very small fraction of what's actually required for quarter wave radios. And like I said, I don't know, maybe you're avoiding the question, I don't know. Would 50 feet or 40 feet of well point driven right into the ground is a rod, would that suffice for radios? Now, Barry seems to feel going that deep into the ground would. I'm not so sure it would.
And KC2QIQ with comments.
Glenn recognized. I'm with you, Rich. The great big pipe in the ground as a well pipe is going to help, but not enough. As the center of radiation, the high current point, moves close to the ground, and that's where the high magnetic fields are coming from, even though that great big long pipe might be as long as the other half of the dipole, so to speak, therefore you'd think it would be perfect. Turns out that dirt in your backyard with the salt water that's buried in it and everything else is a lossy volumetric substance. The magnetic field that you're launching locally into that dirt is heating up the worms, making them warmer in the summer. In the wintertime, they're going to be happy, but it's dissipating your RF energy. So the more ground plane radials you can put down, the better. Who was it now? can't think of the guy. He's called it as W-2 something or other. He used to work for Bell Labs.
Harry Civic.
That's the guy. So he did a pretty good study as to how many ground plane radios gives you how much performance on electrically small vertical antennas. So the combination, and by the way, it's more than just a, are you exactly a half wavelength or a three-quarter wavelength or one wavelength or so on. There's a cyclicity to the impedance you see as you change the number of wavelengths of the radiator. Therefore, the current that you're launching into it from the ground, from the, your feeding mechanism, from your counterpoise, it's going to go up and down in cycles, a little bit like a rectified sine wave, if you know what I mean. But on each one of the frequencies you care about, for lat length of radiator, you can figure out exactly what is the impedance, you can figure out exactly how much current you're launching, you can figure out exactly how strong is the current from that counterpoise system that you've got. You can also figure out the centers of radiation, how far above the ground they are. You can get some nice ballpark figures as to how much ground loss you're going to be getting. And that RF will be absorbed by that volumetric material called ground. Over to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, Rich, and everybody in the net. Just a quick comment about, you know, vertical antennas versus the inverted D that Rich was talking about before. Whether it be just a single band inverted D or a fan dipole in an inverted D. Interesting thing there is that, like you're pointing out, the amount of losses with the ground plane antenna at ground level with a lot of ground radials, yes, you have the issue of ground loss, but there's also the issue of altitude. Generally, the higher the HF antenna is in the air, or for that, you know, practical nature, almost any antenna is higher in the air in altitude, you get generally better overall performance. And if you were to compare the vertical to almost any inverted V with some decent altitude as a bound structure where you basically have the counterpoise on both sides, almost always outperforms the ground plane antenna at ground level, Rich. K2RIW, KG2QIQ.
Hey, we're back to those three things that make an antenna work well on most bands. Altitude. If the center of radiation is higher above Mother Earth, that in most cases gives you a lower takeoff angle. Your vertical peak lobe of radiation is lower or parallel to the ground. Therefore, you strike the ionosphere at a more grazing angle. Therefore, you strike the ionosphere the first time further out in miles at a grazing angle, which means the next bounce is further out in miles. And the bottom line is the DX is stronger. You're going to hear further, and they're going to sound stronger. So anything you can do to increase the altitude helps. If you have the resources in your backyard to make up an inverted V, I think it's going to work better than many of these combinations of the ground plane radio. You heard a guy that gave you a super strong signal with a 44-foot long radiator. There's a slim possibility that the status of the ionosphere that particular day was giving you a gangbuster signal between him and you, and is it going to be that strong every day? You've got to be a little bit careful about not choosing the one strong day and find out what kind of a wet noodle the guy is using for an antenna and say, yeah, I want to put up that wet noodle. N2EO, K2RIW. Careful you don't press the wrong button there, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Thank you, Glenn. Dick, well, the fellow he was talking to, he was telling him that he's getting very, very good results with his antenna. I thought of that maybe it's just a good pass between me and him, but the gentleman he was talking to, he was saying that he was working out like crazy with this thing. So I don't know. The best I could do was probably to put chicken wire down, maybe an inch under the ground, cover the whole backyard with chicken wire under the ground, maybe an inch. But again, I can only go out, the yard is 25 by 25 feet. Now, I don't know if that's going to be worth the trouble.
Picked up the wrong mic again. The answer is yes, Rich. Your main radiation portion of that structure is always going to be in the environment you described to us, a relatively small number of wavelengths away from Mother Earth. So there's a couple of things going on simultaneously. How much current you're launching into the ground plane, how much of the radiated signal is looking at the very nearby Earth, which you look at as something solid that you stand on, and to some degree at a grazing angle out in front of the antenna 50 feet away, it is a mirror image device, but locally nearby, it is a volumetric lossy material. You could make believe you've got a great big chunk of carbon buried in your backyard, and the radio signal that sees it, some of it's going to be turned into heat and lost. So anything you can do to shield your antenna from the dirt of your ground is going to give you some increase in performance. Now, maybe the increase we're talking about here is 20%, 1 dB worth, so to speak, which is 1/6 of an S unit, and is it worth all the effort? I mean, there's a price earned, risk-benefit ratio, price-benefit ratio, there's the words I'm looking for, cost-benefit ratio, there we go. There's ways you can study it, but the way you've got the resources to lay down some radials, it's almost always worth doing it because it's not a costly item for you and Barry to do it, and you're always going to get some improvement. How much improvement? Is it worth the effort? There's ways of finding it out. You could model it and find out exactly what it is, Rich. There are computer programs that allow you to model the situation. Maybe that's the next step, to find out whether or not you're spending your money wisely. N2EO, K2RIW.
All right, Dick, that's a good thought. I'm not too familiar with the... I've never used one of these modeling programs. Maybe I'll talk to Bob, W2OSR. I know he uses, I think it's called EasyNeck. Maybe he can model it for me. Anyway, Dick, thank you very much, but you gave me some insight. You did give me some good insight. At least I know why this gentleman was getting out so well on 20 with a 44-foot vertical, because his impedance was high. Didn't require much radials on, much of a ground system on 20, but as we go, you know, to a, like for instance, Jerry Civic, his call was W2FMI, that's who you were thinking of. He experimented with very, very, very short verticals on low frequencies. I remember the articles in QST, and we're talking there a few ohms and teens, so I see what you're saying. The feeling, again, is that I go down to 75 meters, this may not work so well unless I can get a good ground system in. Anyway, Dick, thank you very much. Checks in the mail. K2RIW, TechNet Limelock, N2EO.
Yeah, very fine, Rich. Yeah, W2FMI, Jerry Civic, was on the front cover of QST 20 or so years ago, and one of his super small antennas was, as I remember, an 80-meter vertical ground plane antenna, which looked to me like it was about 10 foot tall. On top of the antenna was a great big umbrella as a top hat capacitor on the antenna. Sitting under that umbrella was his wife in a long lawn chair on the front cover of QST. So that was an electrically small antenna, I believe used on either 80 or 40, and you could tell from the article that he was putting down a very extensive set of ground plane radials, at least a quarter wavelength long, and a zillion of them. He was, although you saw a lot of grass that was under that lawn chair with his wife sitting in the lawn chair, still, he almost radio-wise had turned that backyard of his into a sheet of copper, and that's where the really high performance of those antennas were coming from. If he had nothing but a well pipe as a ground plane radio on that super small thing with his wife sitting under it, guaranteed the performance would have been about 10%. 90% would have been heating up the ground, heating up the earth around where his wife was sitting. Alan, KC2RFN, go right ahead with your question about, I think you said Oscar, K2RIW, listening.
KC2RFN, yeah, I just had a patient with the last name Civic, so I wonder if they're related. My question is about Oscar, but Rich's situation brought up a question. And that's how do you drive 50 feet of pipe straight down into the earth? And then I'll get to my Oscar question.
Yeah, that's a toughie. I can think of various structures you could connect to the side of the pipe, which if its structure was strong enough, you'd be able to hit it with a sledgehammer. In the ideal situation, you'd like to be hitting the sledgehammer on the top of the pipe. But if the pipe starts off 50 feet long, the pipe better be alongside of a tower, and you're climbing up and down the tower with a sledgehammer. You need a pile driver. You better have a very sharp tip on the end of that piece of pipe. It better be a very sturdy piece of pipe. And to drive a piece of pipe 50 feet in the ground, you better have some kind of an end cap to protect the pipe itself, because by the time you get about 25 feet down, the end of the pipe that you're hitting with a sledgehammer is going to be peened over so bad and cracking and splitting and doing all kinds of nasty things. So you have to put a protective, very strong chunk of steel on the end of your pipe that you're driving. I think it really requires a pile driver. You dig the hole as deep as you can to start it off, and after that you do a lot of pounding. Lucky for me, the ground rods I've got in the backyard are only 8 feet. And lucky for me, I was sinking them alongside of the tower, and I was climbing up the tower with the sledgehammer, if you know what I mean. Drag your feet in case somebody knows how to sink 50 feet of pipe and want to tell us how to do it. KC2RFN with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, Barry told me well point comes in 10-foot sections. So you drive 10 feet, put 10 feet more, keep going until you get to China.
Yeah, but where do you stand to drive that first 10 feet? You got to stand on some kind of a step ladder just to know to hold the sledgehammer into place to begin the driving process. Is that true, Rich?
Oh, I know you can use an impact. Barry said he has an impact hammer which would get it down. I had that done with a 10-foot rod, which a number of 10-foot ground rods, which were 10 feet long. An electrician drove them in like nothing with an impact hammer, what they call a Hilti.
Paul Bunyan could do it.
When you see some of the Nova series recently on the drilling they did through the ice in Antarctica, and I think they went down to numbers like 2,000 feet and pick up ice cores, which allow them to look back in history to find out what were the constituents of the atmosphere and the approximate temperature at that time. So they sent down pipes, a 4-inch diameter pipe, something like 2,000 feet. But they used a pretty big rotary drilling apparatus to do it. But for somebody of your resources, Alan, that's possible. KC2RFN, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ in the comments.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I think there's a point of diminished returns, too. Even if you have the capability of knocking a grounding rod into the ground a certain number of feet, I think that what happens is because of well water and just general, the conductivity of the soil, as the depth of the rod finds its way further and further down, that probably after you reach something like 20 or 25 feet, I'm not sure, so sure that you're really gaining much by going any further. And that's even if you know if your pipes are going down straight or just crumbling after a certain point in time, maybe you just hit a big rock or something, 30 feet under the ground. Back to you, the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
For every frequency of interest, for every material that has a known conductivity, there is a calculatable skin depth. So on 80 meters with the conductivity of the soil that's in Rich's backyard in White Plains, in Whitestone, there is a calculatable skin depth. And maybe the answer is 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet. In which case, if it goes 2 or 3 skin depths down, 10 feet, the amount of RF getting there is getting so small that as he sinks the pipes further, it's probably way beyond the lower diminishing return. So there's ways you can measure the conductivity of your soil and go to the right formula and figure out what that skin depth is, and therefore know how fast the RF is falling off as it tries to crawl down the outside of your piece of pipe that you think is the other half of the counterpoise. In reality, it's going through a lossy material. Okay, back to you, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW.
Okay, good to know it's not as easy as... I don't think it would be as easy as it sounded. My question was about Oscar, particularly Oscar 1. By the way, last week at HRU, there was a ham who had showed us how to work the, I think it was AO-27 satellite. A few of us were out there. And quite amazing how easily it worked with a little handheld Yagi. And by the way, it was up and down, both on 2 meters FM. And sounded as clear as we're talking right now. And he spoke with a few stations in Florida and even one in Nebraska. Very neat. When I read about Oscar 1, I know that it was putting out in code HI, and the speed of the code was tied into the temperature of the satellite. but it occurred to me, I don't recall reading anywhere that anybody could work the satellite. That is, I know it transmitted, but did it actually repeat a signal, retransmit a signal? I don't think it did, but I'm not so sure. Maybe you or Paul know. KC2RFM.
I'm going to make a guess and see if anybody wants to correct me. The very first satellite they put up, I think, was nothing but a beacon. I think it just did a one-way continuous transmission, HI, in Morse code, and the rate of that telling you temperature. And I think it was battery-operated. I don't think it had solar cells. And the battery lasted a certain number of days. That is my recollection. I should have read the article. I'm sure it gives you more of the details. Somebody who knows more about Oscar number one, please sign in right now. Give me your call letters and name. KQRIW in the TechNet.
W2AZB checking in.
Okay, I had a double that time. WS2N was the first one. Who was the other person?
B2AZB checking in.
Sound like AD2AZB. Alpha Delta 2, Alpha Zulu Bravo is what I thought I heard. Paul first, W2SN. Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, okay, just from the article, they did use mercury batteries, by the way, 18 volts. And then when they rebuilt it, they went to 12-volt batteries. But, you know, they rebuilt it for the show, and they bought it the satellites in Dayton and different various places for demonstration purposes. And it just sent high, HI and CW. And Alan's right, it was hooked up to a thermistor. And in the article, it doesn't say that it was, you know, the reason for it, but because of it, it went by very, you know, the speed was very high because of the temperature. I remember reading years ago, it's in the back of my mind, I don't know if I'm right, but I think they did that for a reason because they wanted to actually tell the temperature. They used that as a form of, you know, telemetry by the speed that CW for high was coming down at, they could tell what the temperature was inside the satellite. So that might or might not be true, but it rings a bell. I think that is true. And no, it wasn't a repeater. You couldn't transmit up to it and transmit down. It didn't have anything like that. Just a transmitter deck. Back to you.
Very fine, Paul. We have to remember this is the very early days of the space age. I think Sputnik was launched something like 1957. The spacecraft was launched somewhere around 1961, 62, 50 years ago. And the thing that was not very well understood then was absorptivity to emissivity ratio. Depending on what materials and what color are the materials on the outside of the satellite, has a huge influence on what temperature you settle on in space. You and I put a transmitter on a picnic table in the backyard. The air of the atmosphere circulating around that transmitter, going past those fins, has a huge effect on controlling the temperature of that transmitter while it's in the transmit mode. You put something in space where there is no air, you're getting no convection cooling, no conduction cooling to the air. You're only getting T to the fourth radiation. In other words, the rate at which energy comes off something in free space, assuming that the material was a black body, is T to the fourth. In other words, temperature raised to the fourth power determines what rate at which you lose energy in a thermal manner in space. It's only radiation. There's no conduction. There's no convection. You've only got radiation left. And you've got this huge radiating device called the sun. Helios is giving you a tremendous amount of energy. 1,300 watts per square meter is hitting your spacecraft. You make your spacecraft sufficiently black, and it's going to go up to a very high temperature. You make it sufficiently reflective, making it silvery or gold-colored, and it could end up very, very cold. All the energy from the sun hits it, bounces off, none of it gets absorbed. The back end of your satellite is looking at cold space at 2.7 to 3 degrees Kelvin. a very cold temperature. So you got to be very careful on how you paint and how you coat it. When you look at that article, you'll see that there were stripes of material on that Oscar 1 satellite. That was their best guess as to how much absorptive material and how much reflective material should be on the surface of that satellite to try to make it settle at, let me pick a number, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, if that's what they were looking for, something in the vicinity of 26 degrees centigrade. So by way of the HI, they could find out how successful that guess was, because these guys didn't have the resources. Later on, they did. Let me drop this. Later on, the Oscar program had a man named Jan King, W3GEY, I think was his call letter, something in that order, who worked for the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. He walked every day past that space simulating chamber, which is still very expensive to run. But I think on the later satellites, they got permission to put the candidate piece of hardware in a space simulating chamber, in which you can find out with hard evidence what temperature is it going to settle in at. Those kind of resources in the very beginning didn't exist. The fact that they were getting a boost at all as a guest on somebody else's rocket was, again, quite an accomplishment in the beginning. That's a bunch of opinions. Anybody else want to give us more information? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'll add one more comment if anybody else doesn't have one.
Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Zulu Bravo, Phil, checking in.
Yeah, Kilo Delta 2, it's not Alpha Delta 2. All righty. Right after we finish with Alan, we're going to go to you, sir. Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, referencing that the article Paul was talking about, I had always wondered about the that strange shape of the satellite, kind of a rounded trapezoid, and I thought there was some sort of significance to its shape as far as its presence in space. And as it turns out, according to the article, the reason for that strange shape was simply because it was to match the contour of the inside of the rocket that took it up. So, kind of like cutting the foot to the size of the shoe instead of the other way around. Just an interesting little tidbit. KC2RF, back to you, Dick.
Yep, it had a fit. They were a guest on that vehicle. There was a little bit of space left over. It was a round vehicle. They had to be a quasi-round shape to fit in there. KD2AZB, awful glad you signed in, Bill. Now I recognize who he is. I think this is the first time he signed in. I don't think you've been on 2 meters too long yet, Bill. A man with a fairly new license, as I remember, who works for the laboratory in Cold Spring Harbor. And you run into a man who had something to do with the creation of the understanding of how the DNA helix works. And I think you run into him periodically. Go right ahead, Bill. KD2AZB, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Hello, Dick. Yes, this is Bill, KD2AZB. And, you have a good ID on me. I do run into a Nobel laureate at lunch every once in a while. He was kind enough to give me a tour of his house one time, and he's pretty proud of some of the paintings on his wall. I was having some questions about the chance of my hitting the repeater out by you, the Limark repeater, west from a handheld transmitter, a Waxon. I've been having a lot of difficulty trying to do that, trying to break in today with the handheld. Right now I'm phoning in from Yaphank headquarters of the Red Cross at the county chapter. Maybe you could give me some advice.
Yeah, I'm hearing you good and loud on the input, 146.25, Bill. I was about to say, my goodness, you took some of my advice. You and I had an email back and forth in which I was suggesting that you do put an antenna on the roof of your house in Wisconsin, and you will be able to easily, in my opinion, sign into the eastern input of this machine on 147.375. And right now, I guess you're at a different location, so that's how you're getting in so well, and you're doing a very good job. By way of a Yagi antenna you could put on the roof of your house, even if you're only running a couple of watts of power out of that transmitter you're describing, I'm reasonably sure you will be able to sign into this repeater from your home QTH. On 2 meters, you'll be amazed what happens with altitude. I was only being conservative when I told you that as you raise the antenna from your hand in the living room to a piece of cable going up to the roof of the house, going up to the chimney, to a Yagi or a ground plane antenna, even if it's made out of coat hanger wire, you will be 100 times stronger, 20 dB stronger, and maybe more. And so I give you a 50-50 chance. With a simple antenna on the roof, you're going to make it. The antenna is almost everything. The number of watts are nowhere near as important by comparison. For you to go up 100 to 1 in power and be battery operated, I don't have to tell you how difficult that would be, to go up 101 power by just changing the altitude of the antenna. And the kind of antenna makes a huge improvement. The study of, let me drop,
WS2N.
Paul recognized. In fact, we're going to find out from Paul in a minute what he's using out there. He's way out there in Ronkonkoma, and he's not on the top of a mountain, if you know what I mean. And he's getting into this repeater with some reasonable number of watts. So the antenna is everything. What the heck was I about to say? I had another point I was going to make. But propagation is a complicated subject, the way radio behaves. If you stood on the roof of your house and looked to the west, if you're looking into a clump of trees that are 20 foot higher than you, of course that's going to hurt a lot. If you've got a reasonably clear sky to the west, which is where the repeater is, the one you're listening to right now, you're going to make it. Even if you don't have clear sky, you can still make up a lot of extra signal strength by directivity of the antenna and altitude of the antenna. So, Paul, you're quite a bit further out than Bill is. Tell us what you're using for an antenna and how many watts you're putting into it and how many feet above the ground it is, because I think where you live in Ronkonkoma is reasonably flat land, and there aren't very many tall mountains there, if I remember. WS2M from Ronkonkoma, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm right near the lake. I thought he said he lived in Wisconsin, which is really all that far away, but based on that, I used to make this repeater hit and miss with a vertical. I had an isopole at one time, and I was okay sometimes, other times not too good. And even when it was good, if I tried to check into this net, there would be transmissions from Connecticut, from their repeaters up north. And that would really take out the Limelight repeater out here. So that was pretty tough. And in those days, we didn't have Selvin online, the Eastern input. So next best choice was the beam. That's what I have now, the Cushcraft 10-element beam. And that's on a rotator, so I pointed west, and I get you guys great, and no problem. And, of course, if I want to go on a simplex net, which is in Connecticut, I just turn my beam north to Connecticut. We drop it.
And you might mention whether or not your beam is vertically polarized, Paul. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, it's set up for FM. Vertically polarized beam. And nice thing with that Cushcraft, you can go one way or the other. You can set it up for a sideband or the way I have it for FM, vertically polarized. And that's mounted to an Alliance HD73 rotator. It sounds like overkill, but I used to use that for a homebrew two-element 10-meter beam. But I just use it for this Cushcraft, and it works great. It's no problem. And, if the Connecticut people are on now, and if I wanted to hear them, I could just turn that beam, and I'd lose Limelight. But if I want, I'd say 100% of the time now, if I turn it toward the city, even if they're on, I don't hear them at all with the beam.
And one final question that Bill would like to know. How many watts are you running right now, Paul? There's a little bit of hiss in the background as you get through the machine, which is 30 miles, 25 miles to the west of you in right at the Nassau-Queens border. So how many watts are you running, and how many feet above the ground is the antenna, the 10-element beam that you're using right now? Go ahead, Paul.
I used to have the beam high about 30 feet. Now I'm down to about 17 feet. I found out that, you know, the height of my antenna is directly proportional to my age. So as I'm getting older, it's getting lower. Just in case I have to do something on it. But I don't know. I think I should get some aluminum pipe and get it up higher. Right now it's all galvanized steel. Very good, but very heavy, very hard to handle. So, yeah, 17 feet above ground. Works good. And the other question was how many watts? 50 watts out with, actually 55 watts out with the ICOM 2100H. Just a mobile rig that I use for a base. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so in my opinion, you're giving Bill some pretty good pointers. 17 feet above the ground, Yagi antenna, 50 watts of power, way out in Ronkonkoma, and that's the way you're getting into Queens. A little bit of noise in the background, and some variability. The propagation on a VHF frequency, you'd like to think it's the same from day to day. There is some variation. There are some nights when you get a layer of moist air close to the ground, which has got, because water's got a dielectric constant of 81, the water vapor added to the air increases its dielectric constant, slows down its velocity of propagation. So high humidity air down low, drier air up high, gives you a downward bending of the wave. It's called the super refraction phenomenon. And if the super refraction is just right, where the signal follows the Earth curvature, the man 600 miles, 400 miles away from you will sound like he's in your backyard. And on the 10 gigahertz ham radio band, that happens some portion of every 24-hour day, particularly beyond midnight in the summertime. That's how, with a quarter of a watt of power on a 2-foot dish and 100 feet of tower, I talked to a guy 380 miles away on 10,000 megahertz radio, single sideband. So as you put up a better antenna, Bill, you're going to see, let me drop.
My signal should be a little bit better. I moved the antenna a bit, Dick.
It sure does. And you peaked it quite a bit better, Paul. Let me drop. Altitude, antenna directivity, power output, even your little handheld transmitter with an afterburner brick amplifier. There are kinds of brick amplifiers that will take 1 watt in and put 50 watts out. I think there's a version that will take 10 watts in and put 180 watts out. So with adding a brick amplifier to your handy talkie, you can boost your power if need be. You have the resources, Bill, as you can see. A man who can talk on a daily basis if he wants to, Mr. Watson, of DNA fame at Cold Spring Harbor, you have the resources. It's just a matter of you deciding to apply them. I wonder how many 2-meter FM repeater contacts you've made so far, Bill. I think your license is about a month or so old, if I'm guessing correctly. KD2, Alpha Zulu Bravo, K2RIW. You got it, Bill.
Hey, Nick, yes, this is KD2AZB over here, and the brick amplifier was the first thing that I heard, actually, that gave me some hope. I figured I was pretty far away from the specs of 20-some-odd feet in the air with a rotor and 50 watts. I've got a handheld here not what I'm talking on right now. But the handheld, I actually drove over, you know, taking your advice, going for altitude, drove over to the Brookhaven Amphitheater, and I finally got some contact of reception on 146.85. It took some time. I was trying with a PL-136.5, and that certainly was not going to work out. I was able to hit the Selden repeater before the TechNet came up, but for some reason, any contact I made there, again with a PL-136.5, did not seem to get back onto the TechNet. Maybe you could give me some advice on that point.
Yes, I can, Bill. Right now, the tie-in between the Selden repeater and the Glen Oaks repeater in Queens is an IRLP computer link, and the way the computer works in order to establish that link, it has latency to it. In other words, sometimes it links up with 3 or 4 seconds of time delay the audio in one end versus the other end. Sometimes the computer connected to the Selden repeater times out, even though the 8.5 repeater did not time out. There's a fair number of periods of grief. In other words, to really use the Selden repeater to hold an extensive conversation to people who are using the Queen's repeater does require some extra knowledge. Let me drop. Like if you don't wait for that, all four of those beeps, for instance, where the whole darn system can reset, you can time out one machine versus the other and so on. They're working on that one, Bill. In other words, they're in the process of establishing a 900 megacycle link that when it is up, it'll be a direct RF link with control signals over that RF link linking the two repeaters, and therefore there'll be no delay time per se, and the timing, the dropouts, and all of that will work a hell of a lot better. So it does require extra skill, and it requires people who are not jumping the gun and making sure that you wait for all the beeps during the TechNet in order for a person to have an extensive conversation with us through the Eastern repeater. So those details are being worked out, Bill. It'll eventually go away. So out of curiosity, Bill, as a brand new ham, how many 2-meter contacts have we made so far? KD2AZB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Put your PL on, Dick.
I'm hearing him on the input, and he'll be putting it on. Stand by. Bill, I've got some...
WWH4YY on the input.
Yeah, I know. Bill, I got some bad news for you. I think your PL dropped out. You must have hit a button or whatever. That whole last transmission, I'm hearing you gangbusters on the input. Nobody through the repeater was hearing you. So the PL appeared to have failed on that one. One of the things he was asking, as you probably heard on the input, Paul, was what's the lay of the land like where you are? You did say you're right at the lake level. I think that pretty much defines it. Let's give Bill a quick transmission. Bill, did you find the method by which the PL dropped out on your particular transmitter? That last transmission, beautiful, strong audio and RF, but without the PL, the machine was not repeating. Oh, wait a minute now.
Because the PL is turned back on at 11 o'clock, so that's what happened to him. There was no PL before then.
Yeah, that makes it more sensible. This machine is operated in the non-PL required mode during the TechNet only. Unfortunately, it's only that way between 8 o'clock and 11 o'clock. At 11 o'clock sharp, only PL transmitters get repeated. So until you find a way of putting on that PL, we're not going to hear you through the machine anymore, Paul. Bill. Bill, did you find a way of turning on the 136.5? Right now, either the PL is not on, or it's not on with enough volume. The machine to the west of you is not recognizing your 136.5 PL at this time. Back to you for a brief transmission, Bill. KD2AZB, K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay. You had to go to 141 to receive anything. Okay. What's going on is that... The 8.5 repeater has a 141 PL on its output, a 136.5 PL required on the input. That tells me that the radio you were using was in the PL required mode on reception. There's various modes you can put the radio in. You can put the radio in a mode where it transmits 136.5 on transmission and will only open up its squelch if it hears 141 on receive. So you were in the squelch, you were in the PL required mode on reception. There's got to be an easier mode you can be operating that radio in. As you study the manual, you're going to find that out. I think Joe wanted to make a comment. W2RYY, K2RAW, go ahead, Joe.
It was actually a question for you, but the comments about these jap radios are, have either T or TSQ. If you put the radio T, it'll transmit PL tone only and can be carried as squelch receive. It's a TSQ. It requires the same tone probably on encode and decode.
So it sounds like there's some other modes of operation you have to find out about, Bill. There's ways of setting the radio so it'll listen to anything without PL required on listening, but on this particular repeater, 99% of the time, except during the first 3 hours of this TechNet, if you don't have 136.5 PL on transmit, you don't get repeated. Thank goodness you signed in for 11 o'clock or we never would have found you. Although, I always listen to the input. I guess I would have found you. I would have known something funny is going on. Alrighty. Let me think.